Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
I feel like a locomotive sipping, drinking Arizona. Mixtape just around the corner. Did a lot in California. Can't wait to drop this, don't you? Yeah, they gon' have fun with that. Smash like
hello and welcome back to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One. It is Thursday, January 12th, 2023. I did it. I said 2023, not 2022, not 2020, not 20 anything else. But hey, little victories, you take them where you can get them. Mark Daly and Mark Hamilton here to bring you the latest news from the Formula One world. Hammy, how are you, my friend? That's a big smile for a Thursday night. Are you ready to get the weekend started here?
You know, I'm happy for Lewis Hamilton. Congratulations, Sir Lewis Hamilton, on your 38th birthday. I am ready to celebrate that. And I'm also ready to celebrate the fact that the weekend is here and I'm 1 week away from a trip to Toronto to see my favorite NBA team play the Celtics. And of course, 2 weeks away from a fun trip to Portland, maybe be able to see some of our listeners when we're down there. But yeah, dude, I'm in a good mood. And this is the off season that just keeps on giving. I was sitting here earlier today as I was kind of putting together the outline for tonight's show, and I don't recall, at least in the modern history. So when I say modern history, I mean like maybe post 2014, but I don't remember an off season that had so much to give to us. It's been an exciting ride, and we've got a ton of stuff to talk about tonight. And we'll be back on Sunday, so we're going to record a show on Sunday. We'll do a mini show and a mailbag show because we've got so much content. And then, of course, we are literally on the cusp of the car reveals as well, just weeks away, almost at the point where we're hours away at this point. But the season's going to come so fast, man. Dude, how the heck are you?
I'm doing good, man. Much like yourself, I'm looking forward to getting the weekend started. You know, it is Thursday night and Friday. Not such a bad day at work, so looking forward to getting through that and just cruising on into a couple of days of what I'm hoping is going to be a little R&R, but we'll see. There's weekends around here tend to be busier than the week itself, which is busy enough. But anyways, at least not on the clock having to run from one thing to another, but it's all good. But just talking about some of those things. So according to your timeline here, 45 days until winter testing begins, 47 days until season 5 of Netflix's Drive to Survive drops, 55 days until the first Grand Prix of the year in Bahrain. So it's ticking down nicely. So car launches, Williams says confirmed for Feb 6, AlphaTauri Feb 11, McLaren Feb 13th, Aston Martin February 14th, McLaren February 13th, Ferrari February 14th, Mercedes February 15th, and Alpine February 16th. Those dates are going to come up really, really quick. It's exciting, man. And it's fun too, because sometimes you see some kind of like a lot of speculation of what the cars might look like, but it's always cool to get that first one. And then after they're all done, it's like, okay, let's just do this thing. Let's get the season started. But it's going to come fast. Looking forward to it.
I should add as well that one of the questions that's popped up quite a lot recently is whether you and I are going to sit down and do the power rankings of our first impressions of the car and the livery. And I think, you know, I'd completely forgotten that we did that last year, but the reception seems to have been so strong and so many people have been asking for it that I think as soon as we get through that 10th car reveal, I think we jump on the podcast and do our power rankings of our first impressions of the cars and the liveries.
Is that when we did like our bracket, like our March Madness bracket, or was that the year before?
I can't remember. Maybe we did it both years? You know, it's funny. I think maybe we did it both years.
I think we did. I know we've done something, but doing the bracket, like, you know, March Madness, it's kind of sad, you know, very timely and very applicable. So we'll do that again. That's always fun. And are we going to binge watch the whole season of Drive to Survive when it drops on Friday?
I can't do that again. I did it last year, man. Well, actually, it's so funny. So the last 2 years where we've actually come on and done our review of the Drive to Survive series that just dropped, I hadn't finished it either year. I think I revealed this to you later, but I was winging it. I can't. Do 10 hours of TV in a single weekend, man. It's just not my style.
Oh man, it's just like, do you even Netflix, bro?
Takes me an eternity to get through any season. So I am the viewer of broken TV series. I start many shows, I get through the pilot, I'm like, I will get back to that. I never do. So I started Stranger Things?
Yes.
The Netflix show.
Stranger Things.
Which one?
Yeah.
Stranger Things. I started season one in November of 2016. I watched the first 4 episodes. This show is great. I can't wait to finish it. 6 years later, I haven't actually gone back. So that is how I consume my TV in bits and pieces. By the way, I should mention as well, thank you to Sam Cooper of Planet F1. He made time for us, came to the Scuderia F1 virtual podcast studios last weekend. We recorded a great podcast and dropped it on Monday. Highly, highly recommend you guys check that one out. And just a couple of other news things I want to hit before we move on here. Big news in the world of Formula One content creators. Matt and Tommy from WTF One are leaving. Apparently, they made an announcement earlier this week that they're departing WTF1. I didn't realize this, but apparently Tommy had some principal ownership stake in it because, of course, it was his baby. He brought it to fruition a decade ago, but he'd sold it on some time ago. So they've officially handed the baton on to some new talent over there. And it's suggested, it's implied somebody has done some deep dive, but it looks like Matt and Tommy are probably going to go off and start their own new F1 project. But of course, that's sad to see. Hopefully they'll take Katie with them. And then the other big one that I definitely wanted to mention today, because this is super exciting. You and I have a really cool podcast coming up on February 19th. We'll be interviewing Elizabeth Blackstock and Alanis King, who of course are fantastic motorsports and automotive journalists and writers. Also, they have their own F1 show, the Donut Racing F1 show, which is doing really, really well. They'll be joining us on February 19th to do a discussion and a conversation about their Rich Energy Haas book, which is absolutely banging on the charts right now. And we are also going to be giving away 3 copies of that book. So the contest is live now. If you want to go and find us on Twitter at F1, actually, what is our Twitter handle? At Scuderia F1 Pod. We have pinned it to the top. You can find it. The contest entry is really simple. You just need to follow a couple of folks on Twitter, like the post, retweet the post, and you're good. But we are going to be drawing those winners with Alanis and Elizabeth on February 19th. So super excited that we are able to do another contest. We didn't do any in the holiday season this year, which was a big miss. And I think a lot of people were pretty sad about that. But hopefully this makes some amends for the fact that we weren't able to deliver anything fun in November and 20th this year.
It is applicable that, or very, I guess applicable is the right word, that we are going to sit down with Elizabeth and Alanis and talk about Rich Energy, because Rich Energy is to Formula One sponsorship what this podcast is to Formula One podcast. So, you know, there's a lot of similarity between the two, but no, we actually did think this podcast is available. I still have no idea if and where, and if it's even possible to buy a container, a bottle, a can, a pouch, crystals, whatever it is, you know, and, you know, a powdered mix and put it into a glass of water and bake Rich Energy drink, because I don't know if it's even actually physically existing somewhere.
My friend, I don't know if I ever told you this, but I tried very hard the last couple of years to get 2 cans because I wanted us to do a live taste test on the air. So you know what we could do is, like, I'll blindfold you, or I'll give you 2 cans that are shrouded in paper. One's Red Bull, one's Rich Energy. You know what? Let you try to guess which one is which, and then you can kind of describe the flavor, and then I would do the same thing. Think it would make a fantastic podcast segment. I just can't find the stuff anywhere. It's like it's never existed.
It's like unicorns or, you know, other mythical creatures,
totally,
or something.
Totally.
Maybe that's what it is. Maybe you have to go into the Enchanted Forest and look for the unicorn drinking a can of Rich Energy drink. Maybe that's what it is.
It's a Narnia, baby.
That's what it is. Mr. Tumnus has the can of rich energy drink. Yeah. So love it. Okay, so this one, you started off the top of the show wishing Sir Lewis a happy 38th birthday. Four things that are probably going to make Lewis, who all seems pretty happy most of the times, would be slightly less happy, or four incidents that cost Lewis four world championships. Going back to 2007, lost 10 points in China, and he only needed 2 points to win the world championship that year. In 2010, in Spain, he crashed out, and that cost him 18 points. He only needed 16 points that year to claim the world championship. 2016 had that big engine failure in Malaysia that cost him 25 points because he was leading the race at the time, of course. Only needed 6 points to take the world championship away from Nico Rosberg, and that was the one and only title that he won, and he, you know, promptly retired like what a week
as quickly
later
as he attended. Could like I'm out
yeah
I'm out.
Oh yeah, he pulled the plug is in record time. I don't think,
and
I've ever
way, seen
that by
the way for
a
guy that's retired. I swear he spends more time in the paddock now than he did when he was racing. So it's a pretty weak
I know,
sauce
right?
retirement.
Yeah, no kidding, right? And then finally, the one that we're all familiar with, which is going to make a lot of people very unhappy, is the
the restart
last year, end of 21. Yeah. So when he had that incident in Azerbaijan, cost him 25 points, and of course he only needed 9 points to take the championship from Max. But could you imagine? I mean, if he had claimed all those world championships, like
unreal.
I mean.
Unreal.
Oh, man. Unreal. He would be like, what, an 11-time world champion, 10-time world champion? You got to like lose count. It is absolutely
2016,
astounding.
I think I've told you this story as well, but back in 2016, I wasn't able to watch Malaysia live. I think my wife and I were watching it off the PVR later. And so I was staying off social media and all that kind of stuff all day. And at some point, for some reason, just like out of muscle memory, I brought my phone up and I went to the BBC website and the photo was a Mercedes with fire coming out of the back of it, and I knew instantly and it was an engine failure, and I knew it was Lewis. So in that moment, so I went and watched the race, and of course that was exactly what had happened. Was a catastrophic engine failure, which was so unlikely because those Mercedes power units had been rock solid in 14, 15, and 16. And of course the race still went down to the final race in Abu Dhabi, but that point spread was just too great at that point. And had he won that race, to your point, he probably would have won the championship. Does Nico retire? Like, the entire landscape of Formula One is maybe different. In 2021, that was the race, of course, where Max had that really unfortunate, super scary tire failure at high speed on that main straight. And there was that subsequent restart, and Lewis had made a unforced driver error in the management of his brakes. And on that restart, went straight through turn one. And he was possibly going to take the lead at turn one, maybe keep it through lead to turn two, but that possibly 25 points, 15 points, 18 points, like that could have been the difference in the 2021 championship too. So there's these ever so fine margins in terms of driver execution, but also the reliability of the car, which goes back to the factory and the mechanics and the stresses on the engine over the course of a season.
Yeah, it really is incredible. Like,
and shout out courtesy Finlay58 on Reddit for compiling that list. We pulled that off of Reddit a couple days
ago. Yeah, 100%. So the next one, because you're a stats guy, I'm a stats guy too, but I just don't understand this next stat that you have here, also from that you found on Reddit from Bence1239. So this is F1 World Championships per 10 million people. So I'm not quite sure what I'm looking at here. So maybe you can kind of like tell me what's going on.
I was going to rely on your superior intellect to interpret this, but this is a neat chart, and the chart is labeled F1 World Championships per 10 million people. And to put this into context, Canada has scored 0.26 world championships. Of course, we have one in 1997, but 0.26 for our population of just shy of 40 million. The US has 0.03. So we have a better, I don't even know what to call this, a better championships to population index than the US does. Brazil, 0.37, Argentina, 1.09, Australia, 1.95, South Africa, 0.17. And I think I'm going to have to zoom in here so I can see some of these European countries. UK 2.97, France 0.59, Germany 1.44. That's surprisingly low considering the number of championships they've secured. Spain 0.42, all Fernando Alonso. And then there's a particular Scandinavian country at the top of the map that I don't think I even need to mention that has 7.39 championships per 10 million people, which is, and I think you can all guess what country that is, which is absolutely absurd.
I know, but I'm going to give you a geography test now. Which is the Central European country that has a championship per 10 million people index ratio, or whatever you called it, at 4.46?
Hold on.
You can zoom in. Take your time.
I'm trying to zoom in. Hold on. I can't
cue the Jeopardy music. You can't zoom in that far.
I
want you to do it because
you're the worst co-host ever.
No, it's Hungary, isn't it? Isn't that Hungary? I can't quite tell because I can't zoom in either.
Is it a landlocked country? Because if it's a landlocked country, it's definitely Hungary. Yeah, so it's Hungary.
Yes, yeah, it is Hungary. But also, then I'm going to put you on the spot here. So who are the American world champions and who is the South African world champion?
So the American champion would be an Andretti, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And the South African champion would be Schechter? Mr. Jody?
Yes, Schechter.
Yep.
But did Phil Hill not win the world championship for Ferrari way back in the 1960s? He was an American too, was he not? But I just can't remember if he was
a world champion. Yeah, he was definitely American, but we're such terrible hosts. But hold on, let me Google this. F1 world champions.
Yes, he was. He was. So you were correct. Mario Andretti was one. Phil Hill indeed was the other one. I'm just trying to pull up the year that he was. So he was a Formula One world champion in 1961. So there you go. So here we go, dropping knowledge all over the place here. So
we're learning.
we're learning and we're passing it on as we go. So this
by the
next
way, that
one here,
Phil Hill championship, he secured the championship in the seventh race of the season, which seems incredible. It was an 8-race championship, which just shows you how much the sport has grown since that time.
Oh, I know, right? But that segues nicely into this next one here, courtesy of Space Giraffe 2000. So this is, so everybody knows, well, not everybody knows, but Hermann Tilke and his company have designed a heck of a lot of Formula One tracks. So going back to 1999, there were 16 tracks and 16 races on the calendar that year. So there was one Tilke-designed track, and that was Sepang in Malaysia, which stuck on the calendar until just a couple of years ago.
Still one of the best tracks on the planet, my friend. Super. Like it was built for modern F1. Like I was watching earlier today a Chain Bear video because I wanted to do a little prep for this, and I didn't realize how wide it was. To give you some context, at its widest, Sepang is 20 meters wide. At its narrowest, it's 16 meters wide. Silverstone, which is generally regarded as a pretty wide track, at its widest is 15 meters. Malaysia was just a phenomenal, phenomenal track that brought the sport into the 21st century, and it's such a shame. And I get it from an economics perspective why they no longer want to pay that sanctioning fee, but I missed that track, I think most people did.
Yes, so do I. Yeah, so they were Malaysia was the first Tilke track added, and that stayed that way until 2004, where they added Sakhir and Shanghai. So that brought it up to 3 of 18 tracks. Then Turkey came online the year after to bring that up to 4 out of 19, or 21% of the tracks on the calendar were designed by Tilke. Then fast forward to 2008, you had Marina Bay in Singapore and Valencia in Spain. So that bumped it to 6 out of 18 races for 33%. Then you had Yas Marina, which has been on the calendar ever since in 2009. Then we added Korea, India, Coda in 2012, which meant in 2012 we're up to 20 races. 9 out of 20 races at that point were designed by Tilke, and we should mention at that point that Istanbul that dropped off the calendar there. Then in 2014 we added Sochi in Russia. That was 7 out of 19 races. But we lost Korea and we lost India. Then it kept going. Then 2060, we added Baku City. That brought it up to 8 out of 21 or 38%. And it kind of keeps going that way. But in 2021, 5 out of the 17 races or 29% were Tilke designed tracks. We had Turkey, the outer ring at Bahrain, Singapore, Kota, Azerbaijan, and Shanghai. Then the last in 2021, 7 out of 22, and 2022 was Marina Bay. And then 2023, 7 out of 22 races will be Tilke designed tracks. And this will see the debut of Las Vegas, which is that's an amazing stat. To say that these people have a monopoly on the design of Formula One tracks in the past two plus decades, almost a quarter of a century, is really, really crazy. That's a very, very massive number. Okay, we're going to take a real, well, no, before we go in there, it seems that Zhou Guanyu is rubbing shoulders and doing some things here. He's done a photo shoot for Dior, so Joe looking he's looking pretty sharp, I must say.
Him.
He's got a good,
I like the cut of his
I like Zhou Guanyu.
He's one
me too.
I really, really am rooting for him and his success. And I hope he does great things for the sport in China. And even if we're, even if China's not back on the calendar this year, I think we can be pretty confident it will be next year. And I just, cannot wait to see how that crowd in Shanghai reacts to a Chinese driver on the grid. I think it's going to be a pretty cool moment.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he would be, I would think he'd be treated like a rock star, and, and rightly so. He always cheer for the home team, or in this case, the home driver. Anyways, Hammy, let's take a quick break here, jump into the mailbag on the other side, and then we got lots and lots of news to talk about. So we'll do that in just a moment. So don't go away. We'll be right back. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right, welcome back to the show. Mike's unmuted, coffee's locked in, loaded. We've got the news feed already here. So the first one here, and I should enlarge this a little bit so I can read it properly. Going to dive into the mailbag, and I overshot it here on my notes. So this is just building off of what we were talking about last week. Just the whole the FIA banning personal statements and things like that in Formula One. So we got a really good email from Jen Swafford, and Jen had to say, "Hey, happy new year, and I hope all is well. I think both you guys have been sick semi-recently, and I hope you're feeling better. I wanted to reply to your recent show when you talked about the FIA ban on political statements. I don't disagree with anything you said, and I agree it is a complex issue. But I don't believe it can be discussed completely without bringing up the fact that this ban came about only after Seb retired. In the discussion about driver activists, Seb and Lewis are always the drivers that are named. Is it a coincidence that the ban came about when Lewis was going to be the only one left? I'm not suggesting that this is some huge conspiracy or overt racism. But when you consider the jewelry ban, another ban that affects only Lewis, you have to consider what is going on. Political activism exists because ideas, beliefs, and behaviors of a minority are being suppressed by the majority. So it is just kind of tiresome that the FIA is behaving like so many other corporations / organizations, protecting their sponsors, silencing the detractors, and, as happens so often in our society, certain minority groups are always affected more than others. Of course, I also completely understand that this is a private business and they can run it however they want. I will always stop short of crying censorship because I understand this is actually not the same thing as suppressing free speech. Interestingly, I got into F1 at a time when it really hit me as a progressive / liberal enterprise circa 2020, but I have learned since that I was seeing it in a way precisely because of Lewis and Seb, and I can turn around and see it from the standpoint of someone who disagrees with their ways of thinking. After all, one reason I've never gotten into NASCAR is that the whole scene feels a little too Confederate to me, and I wouldn't want any new or old fans to avoid F1 for similar reasons. So in a way, I definitely understand the desire to remove politics from the grid. But you have to know that when Lewis heard about the FIA's newest ban on something that he has been deeply involved in when he's the only one left involved in it, he must have rolled his eyes and said, of course they did. That's a great email. And, you know, honestly, I don't have anything further to add to it because I think Jen summed up everything nicely, a lot more succinctly and a lot better than I think, you know, I could have. I don't know if you have anything to add to it, but I think she's spot on.
Yeah, I just want to say thanks, Jen, for the email. Super, super appreciate it. And Jen reached out shortly after the show via DM. So we had a quick conversation and she was able to articulate her thoughts beautifully. The only thing that I would add and I think is really important here is we do it sometimes, me especially. And I think the Formula One community tends to do it, but we demonize the FIA for some of the decisions that they make and some of the ways that they behave as kind of a governing body of the sport. And some of it certainly deserve it. But I think in this case, this is probably something that was decided amongst all of the parties, the teams, the commercial rights holder in Liberty FOM and the FIA. If this was a decision that was made in isolation of the teams and FOM, I think that those bodies would probably have vocalized it by now. But I strongly believe that this is probably something that was put forward by the teams. FIA President Mohammed bin Salam did actually double down on this week. Luke Smith had a really good article on motorsport.com, and he has some quotes from bin Salam here, which I'll quickly read. He says, and I quote, "I'm a big believer in the sport. We are concerned with building bridges. You can use sport for peace reasons on all of this, but one thing we don't want is to have the FIA as a platform for private personal agenda. We will divert from the sport. What does the driver do best? Driving. They are so good at it and they make the business. They make the show. They are the stars. Nobody's stopping them. There are other platforms to express what they want. Everybody has this and they are most welcome to go through the process of the FIA to go through that." He continued, "We just want our sport to be quote unquote clean, et cetera, et cetera." And he goes on, "The FIA should be neutral, I believe, and we need the superstars in it to make the sport. And they do such a great job when it comes to the competition that all of us enjoy." So of course, we discussed this, but the International Sporting Code had been updated, basically saying any sort of expression related to religion or politics or any personal issues have to be approved by the FIA. And like you and I said last week, like I've never taken exception to the fact that these drivers have brought their causes to the forefront and leveraged their platform to the best of their ability, I think, and they should be commended for doing so. Ultimately, this is a business and the business is reacting to the fact that this has been happening. And to Jen's point, I think the departure of Seb made it easier for them to clamp down on something that they probably had wanted to do for some time. I'm just going to be really curious to see how the FIA ultimately executes on this because it's going to be very hard to govern. For instance, they will not allow religious expression. And we have drivers on the grid that wear a cross and that they make religious gestures before a Grand Prix. And ultimately the drivers have the freedom to wear helmets that they design of their choice with graphics and with symbols that are important to them. So is the FIA going to now have to approve helmet designs? And I think this is going to be a very complex issue for them to govern, and it's going to create quite a bit of friction. And it's probably not something that needed to be addressed. to be totally honest, that we probably could have proceeded as we were, because I don't think it was necessarily that disruptive to the sport. But again, the commercial rights holders, the teams, and the FIA disagree. So hopefully there'll be some common ground here. But I would like to see what their approval process is when drivers do bring causes to them. And I would like to see how they govern situations where drivers do things that are in conflict with the sporting code.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I think that this is going to be a discussion one way or another moving forward. But sticking with Mohamed Ben Sulayem, he's had other comments to make this week. I mean, talk about the news that just keeps on giving this season. The latest one builds on the announcement last week from Andretti and Cadillac to launch a bid to try and get into Formula One. And there's been quite a negative and, well, I would think a lukewarm reaction would probably the best way, or the best reaction, or the best way to describe the reaction to the announcement. And Ben Sulayem took to Twitter, and he had the following to say, quote, "It's surprising that there's been some adverse reaction to the Cadillac and Andretti news. The FIA has accepted entries of smaller successful organizations in recent years. We should be encouraging prospective F1 entries from global manufacturers like GM and thoroughbred racer like Andretti and others. Interest from teams and growth markets adds diversity and broadens F1's appeal." End quote. So that is quite interesting. So, we'll talk about this more, because there's plenty of quotes and plenty of stories out there. But apparently, some unnamed source told Reuters News that there's a strong majority of the Formula One teams that are against expanding the grid and diluting the prize money and the revenues and all that stuff. And this same unnamed source said that the majority, or the opinion of the majority, is that this Cadillac or GM involvement is just a badging, a sponsorship exercise. Very much, I guess the best way we could look at it right now is maybe the agreement that Sauber has with Alfa Romeo. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the only thing Alfa Romeo on that car is the branding and the color scheme and nothing more. So I guess that's the real concern there. I mean, going back to some comments made by Mercedes team principal Toto Wolff last year at the Miami Grand Prix, he said, quote, "The value of Formula One is that it's limited to amount of franchises, and we don't want to dilute that value by just adding teams," end quote. I mean, you kind of read between the lines on that one. It seems like Toto is, to me, it seems like he's just against it, period. And also, he says, by just adding teams, it's just like, you know, to me, that kind of suggests like any entry or any application be like, oh yeah, you got the money, whatever. Okay, you're in. It's kind of suggests to me that Toto feels like that there's no vetting process, and it just be like somebody comes up and they automatically would be accepted. Maybe I'm reading a little bit too much into that, but I don't know, Hammy. I'm kind of not surprised by this whole reaction, because remember last season Andretti did try to garner support by wandering around the paddock and was kind of really brushed off by everybody except Renault.
This is a topic I think that you and I will be discussing quite a bit. And we've been discussing really since the Sauber attempted purchase some time ago. But I think that there is, and I'm going to quote here from Andrew Benson, and of course, Andrew Benson, chief F1 writer for the BBC, and sometimes is criticized for being a little bit hyperbolic, but he writes this week that there is a storm brewing in Formula One, and that is a storm between the FOM, the Liberty Group, and the FIA itself. And, you know, he makes some really, really good points. And I think it's important to understand how complicated the situation is getting right now. The FIA, largely in isolation of Liberty and the teams, and ultimately the teams don't get a say, but the FOM, Liberty, is going to act on behalf of the teams because they're so partnered into the financial considerations of the sport. But ultimately, Mohammed bin Salam had put out that tweet and that comment recently that they were going to start ingesting expressions of interest to expand the grid. And I don't think that Liberty, and I certainly don't think the teams were on board with that. And I think it just reinforced the fact that there's some discord here between the FIA and between Formula One. And I think where this gets really messy is the fact that the FIA's role here is to be a unbiased, independent arbiter of the bids that come forward. And ultimately, Liberty and the FIA will ultimately have to sign off. But the fact that Mohammed bin Salam is advocating openly on behalf of the Andretti bid using his own personal social media platforms is not appropriate for the presidents of the FIA. That's a really, really bad look. And ultimately, we're saying that there's been a negative reaction. In fact, that's what Mohammed bin Salam said this week. And he says again, quote, "It is surprising that there's been some adverse reaction to the Cadillac and Andretti news. The FIA has accepted the entries of smaller successful organizations in recent years," blah, 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 blah. It's not that there's been an adverse reaction. It's that there's been no reaction from Liberty and from the teams, because ultimately I think they're very much at their wits' end with the Andretti piece. Like, you made a really good comment a couple of minutes ago that back in Miami, this is a guy who's marching around the paddock followed by cameras and a blank piece of paper trying to get team principals to sign a commitment to adding him to the grid. And I don't think that's how the sport operates. And I think Stefano Domenicali, the CEO of Formula One, I think he was infuriated by this. And I don't think the teams and I don't think Formula One have really appreciated the way that he's allowed this entire bid process to play out in public view. What I know and what I've been told for a fact is that there are other viable candidates working on entries to Formula One, and we know nothing about them because they are negotiating in privacy in the back room doing the deals with their lawyers present, whereas Andretti's letting this play out in public and constantly holding press conferences and constantly being marched in front of the cameras. And ultimately, I want an American team in Formula One. I desperately do, and I totally agree. It's great for the sport. And I think the fact that this isn't playing out favorably for the Andretti group is probably upsetting an awful lot of American viewers and American fans of Formula One, because I think they're frustrated. Like, what else does this guy need to do to get on the grid, right? Like, he was told, or we're told, that he was told that if you want your bid to be taken seriously, you need to partner with an OEM. And so he comes back with General Motors and he comes back with Cadillac. And ultimately, that may not necessarily be enough. And to your point, I think what we're being told this week by some leaks and by some comments that are coming out of the paddock is that the grid themselves, the Formula One teams, don't believe that this is a real works team, that this is nothing but a badging exercise. We know for a fact, we all know, that if the Andretti team hit the grid in 2024 or 2025, which is wholly unrealistic, they need to hire 600 people, build 2.5 factories, and get ready to compete in Formula One. But if they were to come on the grid, there would be a Renault engine in that car that's badged as a Cadillac engine. And I think that in itself is also really starting to annoy teams on the grid, who are starting to become very skeptical of this badging exercise for manufacturers. And I think what we see with Alfa Romeo may be the last time that we ever see this, that teams like Mercedes and teams like Ferrari, who are themselves true works team and are funneling hundreds of millions of dollars into developing their power units, probably don't look kindly on the fact that a team like Cadillac can come in, throw $20 million at Andretti, buy some Renault engines and badge them at Cadillac and get all the exposure to the global community as if they're a true works team in Formula One. And I think that's probably not going over well. And I think the bigger issue here, and this is something that Toto and the other teams have continued to say, is look, we're open to a team coming to the grid, but they need to bring value to the sport, financial value to the sport, in excess of what they're going to extract. Because if a team comes to the grid, we are going to divide the prize money, not 10 ways, but now 11 ways. And that was understood when the Concord Agreement was hammered out and agreed to by the teams in 2020, because they put that anti-dilution fee in place, which was $200 million or a one-time payment of $20 million to each of the team. But the finances of F1 have exponentially increased since then, and a one-time $20 million payment to the teams on the grid is meaningless, absolutely meaningless, because the value of the sport and the sponsorship and the TV money is now so big. So the challenge is, I think the teams are still open to the right entry, but that $200 million anti-dilution fee, that's non-existent. We're talking $600 to $800 million, which in itself is still very small, because if you look at the NBA, we are expecting two new teams in that sport once the current CBA gets hammered out and once they agree to their new TV media deals. It's expected that the Las Vegas team is going to go for $4 billion, and the Seattle team will be there will be a bidding war for that Seattle team, and it'll probably go for $4.5 billion. So the idea that a Formula One team can land on the grid for $200 million is pretty laughable. So I think the reality is these teams will continue to talk to Liberty and argue that, look, if a team's entering the grid, one-time $20 million payment to each of us is BS. That needs to be a $80 million, $100 million payment. And at the end of the day, Andretti doesn't have $600 or $700 million, and GM's certainly not going to bankroll that. And I'm not saying that there are other teams that are, but I see a lot of people saying that this is about greed. This is greed. This is greed. I'm like, of course it is. The 10 teams that are in Formula One have spent hundreds of millions of dollars building their brands and building their factories and competing in the sport, all so that they have a shot at the prize money every year. They have every right to resent somebody coming onto the grid that isn't going to add value to the sport. And I think the silence this week has been incredibly powerful. But I am confident that there are other teams negotiating with the FIA, and they're negotiating with Stefano Domenicali, but they're doing it quietly and they're doing it professionally, and they're not taking the same brash approach that Andretti has. Now, I said last week that I was super excited about the Andretti GM bid, and it was the first time I'd been excited about that. But I've also learned a lot more about the GM bid, and I'm very cool on the idea of GM coming in with a technical partnership with Andretti, but buying the power units from Renault and rebadging them. So I know I've said a lot. I think it's a very complex issue, and it's not going to be solved anytime soon. I think the FIA is hoping to conclude the expressions of interest phase by May, but at the same time, that's their timetable. Nobody knows what Formula One timetable is. Nobody knows what Liberty's timetable is. And again, I want a truly American-based team in Formula One. But I think Liberty's probably still looking at that Porsche bid and the Ford bid and the Hyundai bid and all these other considerations that, for all we know, there could be much stronger candidates out there than this one that are negotiating in the back room. But I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, it's interesting because Andrew Benson from the BBC summed it up nicely when it comes to the Cadillac involvement, and the couple of quotes here that Andrew's rounded up. The first one comes from GM President Mark Roos, who said last week at the announcement, quote, "Vast engineering resources will bring proven success and invaluable contributions to this partnership," end quote. Then Michael Andretti added to that, quote, "The capabilities that GM has are on the level with any Formula One team out there. That's going to help us get up and running even quicker," end quote. So I think that's interesting on a couple of levels, right? It's just like they're trying to suggest that, you know, if we get GM and Cadillac involved, this is going to give us a leg up that a lot of other people don't have. But if you kind of compare to where they are right now, they're still trying to get get officially accepted or be granted that 11th team. You look at where Audi is at and what Audi is kind of targeting, and you know, for their first season in 2026, they're already doing this thing, right? And they realize that even aiming for 2026 is a very, very narrow, small time frame, right? So here comes Andretti. And I mean, we know what their record is like in racing. They're proven winners. We know all that. We know what GM is like as an OEM, but put the two together and aim for 2025. I agree with you. That seems like a pretty unrealistic time frame to try and get a brand new works team up and running. And that's why I can see why a lot of these people, especially these unnamed sources, reputedly some team principals in some cases, are just saying that this is all just smoke and mirrors, and it's just a branding exercise, that they're going to take a Renault power unit and throw a Cadillac badge on there and say, yeah, you know, this is we're Bettworks team and a manufacturer in our own right. So yeah, they're rocking the boat. But it is interesting, like you say, Hammy, that they're conducting this whole business out there in the public sphere, whereas you've heard these other names like Ford, for example, like Hyundai and Porsche, etc., right? That these names get dropped out there, and or they sort of, you know, percolate up through the news feed on a week to week, well, maybe not a week to week basis, but they pop up from time to time, and then they just kind of disappear, and then, you know, maybe something a little bit more speculation or rumor pops up several weeks later, whatever it might be. But the Andretti thing has kind of stayed there a little bit more prominently for a much longer time. But It is interesting, you know, like when you look at what Andretti's doing, and being in the public realm, he was speaking. Michael Andretti, that is, was speaking to Forbes, and he really struck out and lashed out at the attitude of the Formula One teams, and this is not going to help his case.
No, not at all. Totally agree.
Right? Yeah, because I'll read the quote here. He said, "Quote: It's all about money. First, they think they're going to get diluted 1/10 of the prize money, but they also get very greedy, thinking we will take all the American sponsors as well. It's all about greed and looking at themselves and not looking at what is best for the overall growth of the series," end quote. So who knows? Maybe there is a kernel of truth to that, although I do agree that there is like a lot of self-serving interest in Formula One,
yeah,
but
course,
I would like to think that they're not that blind to, like, I mean, the whole idea of expansion is not new. It's been out there for a while. I mean, I could see if there was like no talk about it whatsoever, and all of a sudden the FIA and Formula One announced, okay, we're laying this new team on the grid for next year, Team X or whatever it is, then I could understand that there would be justifiable and expected, you know, outrage and backlash from the other 10 teams, right? But I would like to think that given this much notice and this much discussion, that given the right candidate, the right team, that you know, they wouldn't be that self-serving, that they would recognize, yeah, if we bring this team on board, this is a win-win for everybody. So I would love to see, should any one of these other reputed bids from Ford or Hyundai or Porsche, whoever, you know, if they're successful in doing it, how did they do it, and what did they do right or do different? Should the Andretti, you know, bid or whatever you want to call it, eventually fizzle out and just disappear like a puff of smoke?
You make such a great point when you were reading that quote from Forbes a couple of minutes ago, in the fact that public comments like that isn't a good way to build relationships and to build rapport with the teams, because ultimately the teams do not get to vote on this. They do not have a say, but the teams and FOM Liberty are closely interconnected, and a big part of Stefano Domenicali's job is to protect the interests of the team, because we've had situations in the past where there's been discord between Formula One and the FIA and the teams, and there have been threats of breakaway series. That is to say, teams will leave Formula One and start their own championship. And I'm not saying that's about to happen here, but we've been close to that in the last 15 years. Like, that's how recently there had been a threat of teams breaking away to start their own championship. But I'll just kind of wrap this up with a quick quote here from Andrew Benson in that article, which I thought was really fascinating. And he writes, within F1, this whole situation is being viewed through the prism of what has been a tense relationship between the FIA, F1, and the team since Ben Salem took over. This has been characterized by a series of difficulties, such as a clampdown on driver jewelry, dissatisfaction over the FIA's handling of safety matter, and the political dispute over the number of quote-unquote sprint races this year. many senior figures believe Ben Salem is attempting to demonstrate his power and influence, even in areas where technically he should not be meddling. Just 5 months into his presidency last year, F1 bosses were openly telling teams that they were looking at ways to remove the FIA from the day-to-day operations of the sport. That calmed down for a while through the summer, not least because it's a difficult thing to do as the FIA owns the rights to the F1 championship and F1 merely leases them, but the concerns have never fully gone away. As one team boss said, all that's been going on and it's getting worse. Andretti, it seems, is just the latest person to be drawn into a wider power struggle at the heart of Formula One, end quote.
Yeah, interesting, right? And I was also, looking at this article here from racer.com from Chris Medland, and Chris starts it off. And he says, quote, "I never thought I'd write the words to this effect, especially as a journalist who desperately wants to know as much as possible all of the time. But Michael Andretti, that is, for your own sake, please just stop talking." So you should. I thought that was kind of
That's
funny.
That's advice Anyways, that I've been given many times and I've never listened to it.
Yeah, I know. Likewise. So I'm guilty of the same thing. Chris goes on to say, quote, "Andretti is a racer. His family is full of them. So I don't doubt that a huge driving force behind his desire to enter F1 is simply to compete in the championship. But he's also not an idiot, and neither are the backers from Group 1001 and GM. And the potential value of being an F1 team now and moving forwards is not lost on any of them. It's not just a sporting decision. It's a business one, too. So is the thinking behind the response from Formula One, more specifically the current teams? The biggest question I get from readers is, what has F1 got against Andretti? Completely overlooking the fact that just because the sport hasn't gone crazy at the prospect, it doesn't mean that it's specifically against it. But it won't give away a team an entry purely on the basis of it publicly saying it wants one, and has actually warned Andretti trying to go about it in that way. It's not a warning that has been heeded," end quote. So it kind of goes back to what we were just talking about. Anyways, you should go and check that one out, that article from Chris Medland at Formula1.com. Or sorry, racer.com, pardon me. So, Hammy, let's take a quick break here. We're a little bit late for that. We'll come back. Got other things to talk about. Actually, we'll stick with Andretti for just a little bit longer. Then we've got a couple of other interesting ones here, as well as potential Formula One entries as well. So anyways, stick with us. We'll be back in just a moment, so don't go away.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at armorall.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
All right, welcome back. So sticking with Andretti, just looking at an article here from Jonathan Noble on motorsport.com, and Jonathan posits that Honda is in fact the most logical choice for Cadillac's entry into Formula One with Andretti. So this is an interesting thought. And do you want to pick this one up here, Mark, or shall I try and stumble through this one myself?
No, I think this is a really good conversation. And my sense is that the idea of Honda being a potential partner to GM lies in the fact that the two have been partnering on EV infrastructure and development on the road car side of the business. So there's already a partnership there. But at the same time, we don't even know for certain if Honda is going to be supplying anybody with power units for 2026. Certainly, they've signed up to the regs for 2026, and they're continuing on their journey. But we do know that certainly Renault is committed. And previously, Renault had a signed commitment with Andretti to provide their team with engines. And of course, last year when when Andretti did his stunt in Miami where he was going up and down the paddock getting signatures. The only two teams that were willing to sign on were Renault because they're in desperate need of a customer team. Ever since McLaren left to go to, back to Mercedes, they've been without a customer team. So they're missing that source of revenue, and they're furthermore kind of missing out on the development prospects of having another set of power units on the grid. So I think it's going to be Renault. Honda maybe logically makes sense, but Honda hasn't even committed. And like you read earlier, the leadership at GM have stated that they already have an agreement in place. And I can't imagine they have an agreement in with Honda if Honda's not committed to the sport beyond 2025. And we know that between 2023 and 2025, their role is simply going to be to provide power units out of their Tokyo facility to Red Bull and Milton Keynes.
Yeah, it is interesting, though. I mean, some comments that Alpine Technical Director Matt Harmon made to RacingNews365.com. He said that that not having what he called the distraction of supplying customer engines to Red Bull for the last several years has been a massive advantage for the team. So Red Bull switched over to Honda Power starting in 2019, and then that left Renault supplying power units to its own works team, which has been since rebranded as Alpine, and like you say, to McLaren, who have subsequently returned to to Mercedes Power for last season. It is interesting, though, right? I mean, but that split between Red Bull and Renault, we don't really need to get into it. That had been coming for a long, long time. I mean, you know, even going back to the first year of V6 turbo hybrid power back in 2014, they clearly did not have, like, the Renault out of the three power units, Mercedes, Ferrari, and Renault, it clearly was the third best one. And Christian Horner, even that, you know, that long ago, had been complaining and lamenting about it publicly. So that it looked like it could potentially happen at some point, and it eventually did. So now another team that could potentially come into Formula One is Panthera, who has announced that they want a piece of Formula One. They want to be the Asia's Formula One team. And do you want to talk about this one a little bit more, Hammy? I don't really know too much about Panthera and what they could bring to the table.
In a lot of ways, their bid is not dissimilar to what I think Andretti is trying to do. And I think if you look at the Formula One teams today, 7 of the 10 are fully based in the UK. And that just makes sense because that's where so much of the, I would say, intellectual capital, the people capital exists, and that's where the supply chains are for so many of these teams. So it's always made sense. But on part of Andretti's bid, and this is something that teams are very skeptical about being actually operational, but Andretti bids and hopes to be able to base his team out of a new factory in Indiana, and that would be their principal hub with smaller hubs in Europe. And I think Panthera is hoping to do the same, which is ultimately base the team and their factory in Asia in a hub near one of the Grand Prix circuits. But they also want to be able to build and develop out a driver academy that looks principally at young Asian talent to help build and stimulate the sport at the grassroots level in that region of the world. And again, to be fair, and I think I've said this before, I'm probably not as up to speed with some of the lower formulas and some of the regional formula championships out there. My understanding is that it's a very capable organization and that this isn't the first time they've expressed interest in joining the grid. I think their financial capabilities are such that joining Formula One is going to be a stretch, even at that $200 million anti-dilution fee, plus the costs required to get the sport stood up. But what I am excited to see is that over the course of the next 3 or 4 months, hopefully more and more of these bids do become public, and hopefully we're able to have conversations about why certain bids for these expansion teams, we'll call them, are attractive while others aren't. But I think in a lot of ways, they really want this to be a regional team that represents that that region of the world. And they'll do that through a driver academy and by regionalizing the factory and relying on regional supply chains to build up the team and the car. But the other story here, and this is one that I really wanted to get into with Sam Cooper, at least maybe we will next time, is that there's a prospective investor in Hong Kong called Calvin Low. And Calvin is a very, very wealthy individual who himself has expressed interest in joining Formula One in some capacity. And I think there might be a potential partnership between the two, that Panthera brings the racing pedigree and the knowledge and know-how of how to build and manage a racing team. And Calvin could be the missing link to bring them onto the grid, because as a billionaire who's expressed interest in joining Formula One, that this could be a good marriage between the two of them. And I think this is planetf1.com, a story by our good friend of the show. I can officially say that now, Sam Cooper. But he writes, quote unquote, Panthera are one of many names aiming to get onto the F1 grid, but believe a 2026 spot is likely, and begun working on the FIA's expression of interest process. Asked by planetf1.com if a link up with Lowe could be possible in the future, co-founder and team principal Benjamin Duran said they were open to it. And he says, we haven't talked to Calvin Lowe right now, he told planetf1.com. It was interesting to see his comments in the press, because he's basically saying also what we're saying, that the Asian market isn't the focus right now, the US. So everybody's looking over there. They're all looking west. Nobody's looking east, which is a mistake, but also good for us, because this is what we can bring. So there are a lot of things that are in line with Calvin Lowe. I don't have details about his project, but we are open to everything. We are still in the stage, if whoever comes can bring us something that can reinforce our project and reinforce the bid for F1, then that is good. In response, Lowe said he agreed that the east is a huge market, and said that conversations have already started. He concludes, these are exciting times for the F1 world. Its popularity is increasing and everyone wants to be a part of it. And you know, when Sam and I were talking the other day, one of the things that I thought was really interesting is he speaks to the fact that when Liberty bought Formula One, it really saw two prospective markets to tap into. One was the US, and I think they've done an exceptional job. We're in Miami, we're in Las Vegas, TV viewership is up. There's tons of American sponsors up and down the grid. But the other is China, and in large part because of COVID and the strict lockdowns, they haven't even begun scratching the surface of China, but an Asian-based team could do a lot to help stimulate interest in that country.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? And you know, just, you know, it kind of goes back to like the broader discussion about, you know, what makes Formula One truly a world championship. Is it the fact that they, you know, Formula One races in, you know, a globally representative manner, that you have, you know, each different geographic region is represented? Is it represented by the location of the teams themselves, the drivers? It really is an interesting and bigger discussion. But as we were sort of talking about this, I was looking a little bit further down the show notes here, and this kind of goes back or kind of lends into this conversation here. So in the past 2 decades or so, there have been 10 new teams admitted into Formula One. So out of that that list, only 2 of those teams are still left. So the most recently admitted team is Haas, and they joined the grid in 2016. So they're still in Formula One, but they haven't really lit it up, right? So the other teams that were admitted was HRT in 2010. Virgin also joined in 2010, as did Lotus. So all 3 of those teams are gone. Super Aguri joined in 2006. Toyota joined in 2002. Stewart Racing, they entered in 1997. Then Ford took over the team, rebranded it as Jaguar, and they raced for four or five very unimpressive seasons. And then apparently Red Bull owner Dieter Meischitz walked up and offered them a massive amount of money, reputedly $1, and bought the team for this ridiculous nominal fee, put Christian Horner in charge and rebranded it as Red Bull. And the rest is history there. Another team that joined in 1995 was 40, and then Pacific entered in 1994. They long since disappeared, as is the final team, Simtek, who joined the grid in 1994.
Is there anyone add something real quick to that? Because I think it's
sure,
I think
sure.
it's important that we contextualize some of those exits, because if you go back to the late 2000s and the global economic crisis, we saw the departure of a huge number of teams, especially works teams like BMW exited, Toyota exited, Honda exited.
Yep.
We're really now 15 years later, getting back to where we were in the late 2000s in terms of the participation of OEMs. But in 2010, Formula One was in desperate need of teams to fill the grid, and they looked to three specific teams: HRT, who joined in 2020. Of course, they're long gone. Virgin, who transformed into a couple of other teams. Of course, they're long gone. And Lotus, who transformed into, I think, Caterham. And of course, they're long gone now.
That's
as well.
Yeah.
But all three of those teams, they were small teams. They came into the sport predicated under the belief that the sport was going to institute a budget cap. And of course, that didn't happen until 2021.
For another
but
decade.
All of those teams, entered the sport under the impression and with the full expectation that they would be operating in a very different world. And of course, the budget cap is one of the things that almost broke Formula One with that split array racing series. But all three of those teams eventually failed. And I think Formula One's now like, hey, we could potentially afford to bring on a smaller team, but because there's so much interest, we don't necessarily have to. But it is interesting that in 2010, they were basically opening up to anybody that could put together or assemble a car. And even in 2016, the fact that Haas was able to get onto the grid for virtually nothing is astounding. And that's where I think I get so frustrated with Andretti, that if this was something that you really wanted, you could have done it in 2016 for a song.
I know it's incredible, right? Too, like going back to, didn't we have like at one point two teams called Lotus?
Yeah, at the same
like
time,
about 10 or 12 years at the same time. And one of the Lotus teams was rebranded as Renault in 2014 or 2015 or whatever it was, which is now currently Alpine. But I'm sure if you went back and looked at every Formula One season and the list of teams that were in there, I'm sure that the teams or the list of teams that have come and gone would be literally a mile long. I mean, if you go back to like the 80s and 90s, I mean, they had like Thursday pre-qualifying just to make the grid. And I swear some of these teams just had enough resources to have a driver, have a car and a crew and just show up to races with, you know, the whole goal was just to make it to race day on Sunday. I mean, they had no realistic chance of ever scoring points, let alone a win.
There is episode of the Bring Back V10s Formula One podcast that does a really great story on the fact that Lola, a company that had historically built chassis for Formula One teams and for other single-seater racing series, they came into Formula One in 1997. And at the first Grand Prix, they weren't actually able to qualify. So back then, qualifying wasn't just about setting the grid like you've expressed before. Like you had to qualify to get into the race, to actually race that weekend. Like you could go home without actually participating in the race. They didn't qualify that first race. They had sponsor trouble and they never made it to the second race in Brazil. So some of these teams that have an absolutely deep history and a rich history around the sport sometimes struggle. So that's, I think, where some of the skepticism with Andretti comes as well, that he might be misunderstanding the complexity of building a Formula One team. But then again, if you say that, Haas was able to do it, although, of course, with some deep integration with Ferrari, but moving on.
Yeah, moving on. Okay, Total Wolf, team principal Mercedes, says that series like DTM and Formula E, which are racing series that they all, Mercedes that is, previously raced in but have now left, are now dwarfed by the costs and efforts of Formula One. Anyways, Toto said in an interview with a Polish website, I am not even attempting to try and pronounce. I'm pretty good at trying to get most of these
good,
to go, but
very good.
Yeah, but My Polish is not up there, so I don't want to butcher it. Anyways, Toto said, quote, I think that Formula One has become so big that everything else has been dwarfed. We were really happy, successful in DTM for over 30 years, but it's come to the point where at the works team, if you wanted to compete, you need 40 or 50 million euros on, and a return on investment was too small for that. And that's just the same in Formula E. The audience were just not good enough. So you have DTM there, and then you have Formula 8 here, and then you have Formula 1 in the whole room. So we decided let's concentrate on doing that properly and put the resources into Formula 1 rather than being distracted for the other things. Of course, that's the end of the quote right there. So that is amazing. And he sums it up, right? That the return on investment for DTM and Formula E just basically does not make it worth it. And we saw a lot of these OEMs going into Formula E in what, the last 5-6 years or so? And a lot of them have subsequently pulled out. And basically they've said, you know, we've learned everything here that we really can learn and done everything here that we could really do. So we don't really feel like it's an effective place for us to be anymore. But I just can't help that maybe Toto's admission is the more accurate one, and that when they make the announcement that they've decided to leave Formula E, it really is that they're not getting the ROI that they really need to justify being there in the first place. So bringing it full circle back to the birthday boy, Lewis Hamilton, where we started this this podcast, which seems like an eternity ago, Toto Wolff believes absolutely that Lewis Hamilton will re-sign a new contract with Mercedes as he tries to set the record as the most winningest champion, world champion of all time. So, Hammy, your thoughts on this? Is Lewis Hamilton going to re-sign a new contract? I can't see Lewis not re-signing at this point. I still think he's got something to prove in Formula One. I think that he's still obviously on the top of his game. And it just seems to be, it seems too soon for him to walk away, but ultimately only Lewis knows where Lewis
there
is at.
There is really only there. I should probably use proper English. There are really only two questions that I think need to be answered here, which is, what is the term going to be? How many years? And how much? Because I think he is, especially after what we saw from that team of the back half of 2022, I think emotionally, psychologically, he's in a really good place. And I think he feels the team's getting the car in a real good place. It's shocking that he's 38, because I would argue he's probably the fittest drivers on the entire grid. And I think if there's a sense that this car is going to be competitive and win races this year, and I think there's every expectation it will, especially after George Russell secured that sprint race victory and the Grand Prix victory in Brazil at the end of the season, I think he's going to be motivated to stay, and he's never going to consider anywhere else. I think, like you and I have talked about before, if I'm him, I'm not negotiating not just for a high value contract in the 40, 50, 60 million euro range. I'm negotiating for a piece of the team so I can be a global ambassador for Mercedes for the rest of my life.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, the thing is, I mean, they made Nico Rosberg a team ambassador. I just can't see Lewis being satisfied after everything he's done for Mercedes as a Mercedes driver. That just to me, that just, you know, that just doesn't seem right. It would almost be insulting. It's just, after all you've done, you know, you can be a brand ambassador. You know, you just be a, you know, go out there and, you know, at the pep rallies and pump up Mercedes and go and sign autographs. You know, it has to be more substantial than that. You know, it just anything else just doesn't feel right. Moving along. New team principal at Ferrari, Frederic Vasseur, told Luke Smith at motorsport.com in an interview that he wants quicker, stricter action on future F1 cost cap breaches. And he had the following to say, quote, "Where we have to work to today, firstly, it has been far too long. We need to find a way to have a red light before or to be able to take action much earlier. And we have to probably be a bit more strict on the decision. Okay, perhaps this was the first one, but from now on, we have to forget about minor and major. Because for me, 2 or 3 million, it's not minor, it's mega for development. I think we have to be much more strict and much more quick on the action," end quote. I think that is a fair comment. And I think that, you know, I do see the irony in a Ferrari team principal wanting strict and quick and, you know, open action on breaches and stuff like that, even though he wasn't the guy in charge at Ferrari. That, you know, going back a couple of years to that, you know, technical infraction with the power units. Anyhow, there is a little bit of irony there. But I think he raises a good point because he says, and I think this is the key part of the quote, where he says, because for me, 2 or 3 million, it's not minor, it's mega for development. And I think this is a very good observation because even though he's the Ferrari team principal, he's come from Alfa Romeo / Sauber, which is a small team. And, you know, he's had these smaller budgets to work with before the whole cost cap thing was, you know, instituted just last year. And so you can see how he brings that different perspective that even $2 to $3 million in this current era of Formula One is a big, big thing. And sure, like he says, that this was the first time that we had cost cap breaches and overspends. And maybe that is a good point that it, regardless if it's a minor or major one, shouldn't an overspend be an overspend? It's just like, you know, regardless of the amount. So I think that it's a very, very interesting perspective and comments that he made.
What do you think, I think Hammy? What's valuable about this is that these comments are coming from somebody who's running one of the biggest teams in the sport, right? Like you would expect these comments to come from a smaller team, a minnow, like a Haas or a Williams. But I think it's reassuring that Vasseur is running Ferrari with the mindset of a operator from a smaller team. I do think that the way, and again, give credit to the team at the FIA that are responsible for, I would say, enforcing the financial regulations. I'm sure it's obscenely complex and challenging. I just think they had effectively a trial run in 20. The implementation went into force in 2021. And I think there's some work to do because it got really messy at the end. The fact that we don't know who complied and who didn't comply until two-thirds of the way through the subsequent calendar year isn't good enough. And of course, this year we were expecting the compliance certificates to be handed out and they weren't handed out and there was a delay and the communication was really terrible. And of course, it bled to the media that there was an overspend with Red Bull and Red Bull went to the media and it became very, very, a huge distraction in the middle of the championship. And then it turns out that they did overspend and the whole thing was just extremely poorly managed and it was very messy. So as much as I'm sure it was challenging for the FIA to administer this, it is their job and it's got to be way better this year. Like one, we need to know the compliance and we need to be handing out their certificates in April. We can't be handing them out in late summer, in the fall. And to Fred's point as well, that if there is a breach, like you need to execute on that breach immediately. But you and I have talked about this before. The teams did agree to the financial regulations and the financial regulations are very vague and they're very ambiguous and they leave an awful lot up to interpretation. So hopefully the next time, because I think I agree with what Fred's saying, it's going to be difficult to implement without reworking the financial regulations. So I hope that the next time they go to rewrite the financial regulations, they are much, much, much more black and white and much more clear on timelines and executables in the event that somebody does overspend.
Yeah, 100%. I really don't have any further comment to make to that. But it just, in general, it seemed that when, you know, when there were breaches to it, it just, to me, it almost had like, you know, an inevitable feel to it. It's just like, I wasn't surprised that that it occurred. I mean, some, you know, you had like, you know, the couple of teams that got busted for small things, but the Red Bull one, I mean, remember we went down there with Tim and we looked through it. I mean, we went over, you know, there was a whole list of the items where that got flagged, all these line items on an expense sheet or whatever it was. And I mean, it just wasn't one or two. I mean, it was a couple of dozen things that have been flagged for one reason or another. And some of them were really strange looking. It who knows if it was creative, you know, labeling,
Mr.
or whatever.
Daly,
but we're not going to speculate
before
too much.
We move on to the next story. I just got a press release fresh from Paris, from the Federation International Podcasting, and it reads, effective immediately, All new Formula One podcasts are required to pay a $200 million anti-dilution fee that is to be distributed to all existing F1 podcasts. The $200 million can be sent via Venmo to Mark Hamilton at Scuderia F1 Pod. Trust me, I will fairly distribute it amongst all of the established F1 podcasts, but in fairness to us, not because we're greedy.
Hang on. Can I just hold you for a second? I got Michael Andretti banging on the door here. Let me send him on his way, and then you can continue. Are we good with that?
That's good.
No, but I'm just outraged that anybody would want to jump into the podcast space and take our piece of the prize money. It's just not on.
How dare they? Supplement advertisers. How dare they?
Yeah, I was just saying, if they wanted to, they can take the biggest slice of nothing that they want. We're not making huge amounts of money here, despite wishes to the otherwise. Anyhow, moving along, and Michael, come on, it's time to go home. sticking with the Ferrari, they've decided to give Antonio Giovinazzi another chance at redemption, that he will form part of Ferrari's Hypercar World Endurance Championship lineup this year, 2023, He's had a couple kicks at the can, and he still manages to hang around. I guess he was an academy driver in the past, and he was with Sauber and then with Alfa Romeo. But, you have to give him credit. He's found a way to make himself relevant and stay on the radar there at Maranello. Yeah.
Autosport is reporting as well that Giovinazzi and Schwartzman are set to share Ferrari F1 reserve role, or the Ferrari F1 reserve role, in 2023. So like you say, he's had this kick at the can. And I know that Ferrari was very upset a few years ago that they weren't able to find a full-time ride for him at Sauber Alfa Romeo. And I think they were equally as upset with Haas that they couldn't get him a seat there. And it was good to see those teams flex and show a little bit of independence when it came to driver selection. But for whatever reason, it's really important for the firm in Maranello to have an Italian driver in or around the sport. So it looks like he's going to be involved in a couple of Ferrari projects, and we may see him as a reserve driver, do a couple of free practice sessions this year. And he's obviously going to get an awful lot of sim time in supporting the development of that car.
Yeah, it is interesting, like I say, though, that he has managed to stick around for as long as he has in one way or another. There was something that I wanted to bring up, but while I look for that, let's just go on to a different story here. And this is... So this is going back to the allegations at the end of the season that the whole thing in Brazil where Max wouldn't he basically flipped the bird to Sergio, wouldn't give him the position back, and he got very, very scold. He had a real scolding tone all over the radio, saying that he wasn't give the position back, and they knew why. So afterwards, it came back. There were some allegations that Sergio had allegedly crashed on purpose during qualifying during Monaco. And so, nothing more has really come of it. But Carlos Sainz did kind of hint at the time how deliberate crashes in Formula One, it happens a little bit more often than people might expect, unless we kind of go back a number of years to the time that Michael Schumacher. Yeah. Parked it at Tabac at
Nico
Monaco,
and then at just Monaco basically as well, walked man. Away. It's
yeah, as well. Yeah,
this is just 100%. It's one of those stories that boggles my mind, that the allegation and it seems to be, it's been vaguely reported that it's generally understood within the paddock that crash was in fact intentional. But the fact that nobody in the media has grabbed their cap in their cape and their notepad and put a little tag in the brim of their hat that says Scoop McGee and has gone out and investigated this story to its fullest is crazy, because it's right there, this allegation, this generally understood truth that he intentionally crashed his car, and nobody's done anything about it, because that is in itself a massive scandal. Yeah. And what's even more scandalous is the understanding that this happens more often than maybe we even think, which is crazy.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things on that, these drivers truly are incredibly talented. If they can pull off a crash deliberately on purpose and make it look like, you know, it was, you know, an accident to, you know, mere mortals like ourselves. But, you know, just going back to what your comments there, you know, Mark, about the allegations that Perez crashed on purpose at Monaco, and the fact that, you know, if there was anything to this, why has no investigative reporter, journalist dug into this deeper? Why has this not seen the light of day? But perhaps it's an ugly piece of dirty laundry that they don't want getting out, that would, you know, perhaps really ruin the credibility of the sport,
and that
right?
Team. I mean, and Red Bull
and the team. Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe because, you know, there's not enough daylight between those comments at the end of this past season and what happened at the end of last year, at the end of 2021 in Abu Dhabi, and the whole, you know, Michael Massey race restarts, you know, let's just say shenanigans, just to put it mildly, and the questionable way that that race was restarted. Maybe that there was, who knows what went on behind the scenes, but I just really find it interesting, like yourself, and, you know, I would expect many other people, that these allegations came out, and as quickly as they kind of bubbled up to the surface, you would have thought that it really would have exploded, but it disappeared very, very quickly, which was very, very strange. All right. Well, I did have something else. I don't know where it went.
Oh, the story. Preamble was around the fact that, quote unquote, F1 team bosses pitched solutions for qualifying crashes that cause red flags. And I think, again, the whole impetus, and it's late, man. Cut you some slack. It's been a long week for both of us. You're sliding into a new career here. But I think the story really is the fact that it wasn't that he crashed intentionally. It was that he crashed intentionally so he could secure a better grid slot than his teammate. Because with the superior car, his understanding was, as long as I start in front of Max in Monaco, I'm going to be able to win this race. And I think we saw this, of course, a couple of years ago in Monaco with Charles Leclerc, when he crashed on a qualifying lap. He qualified on pole. Of course, he had mechanical difficulties and never actually started the race. But that's another example of a circumstance where he qualified on pole, but red flags brought out by his crash prevented anyone else from being able to put in a better time. And the conversation has continued to percolate since Monaco this year of what should happen in the event that somebody has a crash or brings out yellow flags or red flags that end the session or delay the session. And I think there's a quote here from McLaren CEO, of course, Zach Brown, saying he believes the simple rule that should be adopted is that which IndyCar has. And he says it would be an easy solution. And he says, I think it should be red flags or yellow flags, effectively impeding a driver from completing their lap. They do that in other forms of motorsports. You just lose your fastest lap from that session. All the drivers tend to do one lap runs anyway. So that would penalize the driver if it was intentional or unintentional, because you've messed up someone else's lap. I think that's an easy solution, and it can be implemented right away. So his argument is, hey, if you're going to crash, you're going to lose your fastest lap from that session, which absolutely discourages drivers from bringing out the yellow flags, Nico, Schumacher, and absolutely discourages this type of behavior, but also punishes behavior like in the Leclerc case. And nobody's arguing that Leclerc crashed on purpose, but his crash was hugely beneficial to his qualifying run. So I think this is good. And I think what they do in Indy works. The other recommendation is, like, hey, if there's yellow flags, red flags, add extra time. I don't like that. If there's a crash, you know what? Delete their fastest time from that session.
Yeah, I think it's a simple solution to make the problem go away. And, you know, if it actually is a problem. And I think it's fairly ingenious as well. But you know why I got distracted and kind of like went over the beat of that story is because while I was talking, I found the quote that I was looking for. And it was so obvious, because in the show notes, you highlighted it. And it was so obvious that I didn't actually see it. But I kind of wanted just to bring it back to the Andretti discussion just as we wrap it up here, Mark.
Andretti sandwich.
And this again was from the Andretti sandwich, and it goes back to the story from Andrew Benson on from the BBC, and where he said an existing F1 team boss described the plan to base the Andretti team in the US as insane, and suggested that Andretti appeared not to have learned the lessons of his own brief flirtation with Formula One as a driver.
And what that means, by the way, is Andretti had, of course, that one season with McLaren, and he was booted with a couple of races left to go. He was criticized at the time.
What was that? 93, something like that. Yeah,
hugely criticized at the time because he wasn't willing to commit to living in the UK full time, and he was effectively commuting from the US. And a lot of people felt that compromised his test time, it compromised the amount of time he was in the factory, it compromised his ability to help the development of the car. And of course, all that added travel was a huge stressor on him. So whether any of that's true, that's what that comment is, that he didn't learn his lesson. And I think the argument is that, look, if 7 of the 10 teams are based in the UK and all 10 teams are based in Western Europe, and you're going to base your factory in the US, that puts you at a significant distance from all of the supply chains, from the entire infrastructure that is Formula One. You immediately put your team at a disadvantage. You don't need to be based in the US. You can be a US team, just like we have non-British teams based in the UK. Renault is based in the UK, and they are very much a French team, but that's what that comment means.
Yeah. It was interesting. I thought it was worth throwing in there before we hang up the headphones and turn off the mics for another. Well, I was going to say another week, but of course, at the beginning of the show, you dropped the announcement that we're doing a Sunday show. Like, oh, okay, I guess I got plans
Two weeks, Sunday, baby.
But
for the whole year, 110 shows.
Oh, exactly. We just kind of like hit our stride a little bit sooner because, you know, before you know it, the season is going to start. So we're going to be in mid season form by the time we get to the beginning of the season. You know, fingers crossed. Anyways, I think that's a good place to park it for this week. Hammy, you've always got an announcement for all the good folks listening at this time.
We really should
time,
do this
each and
at the beginning
show.
Of the show, but if you like what you're listening to and you listen to us on Spotify, if you can give us a rating in app, it's super easy. It just takes a couple of seconds. It means the world to both of us. And of course, if you listen on Apple, if you can leave us a rating and a review, that's equally as amazing, because as we begin to better understand the mechanics, the machinery behind the podcast industry, one of the things that we do know that is a huge boost to our show is getting those ratings and review. And I feel like a YouTuber, a vlogger, but if you can do that for us, it means so much to both of us, and we read and cherish every review.
Absolutely. And if you want to get in touch, easiest way is to send us a tweet at Scuderia F1 Pod. Unlike Mark, I did remember our Twitter handle, which is funny. It's because you spend more time on the official Twitter than I do. But, you know, it's all good. As long as one of us remembers, that's the important thing. Or you can send it the old-fashioned email way to scuderiaf1pod@gmail.com. And that's it, everyone. That's a wrap. Thank you for listening this weekend. We'll be back on Sunday, so look out for that in your feed to end your weekend or start the new week. So until then, enjoy the weekend. Bye for now.